This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Emmy Awards are tonight. The ceremony will be hosted by Seth Meyers. He reached another milestone in his career last February.
From 30 Rockefeller Plaza in New York, it's Late Night with Seth Meyers.
Meyers took over as the host of NBC's Late Night after Jimmy Fallon moved to The Tonight Show. Meyers and Fallon worked together on Saturday Night Live. Seth Meyers joined the cast of SNL in 2001. He became head writer and anchored Weekend Update, initially with Amy Poehler. SNL was his dream job, but Lorne Michaels, executive producer of Saturday Night Live, The Tonight Show, and Late Night, encouraged Meyers to move on to the 12:30 show and make it his own. When I spoke with Meyers last April, we played back the opening of the first time he hosted Late Night. It's an homage to a regular feature Jimmy Fallon used to do when he was the host. Thank you notes.
Thank you, Jimmy Fallon, for taking over The Tonight Show at 11:30 so I could take over Late Night at 12:30. I promise to treat it with respect and dignity and to only use it to do completely original comedy pieces. Starting now.
Seth Meyers, welcome to Fresh Air. That was such a great way of kicking off the Seth Meyers Late Night.
Yes, it was a very nice idea by our head writer, Alex Bays. I was very relieved that we came up with something like that.
Now, I read in an interview with you that one of the reasons why you left SNL for Late Night is that you wanted a saner life. Having a daily hour-long show as offering a saner life struck me as one of the most delusional things I've ever heard in my life.
I'm so happy to say that 7 weeks in, I think I was right.
Really?
I could have very possibly been delusional. But this new schedule, unlike SNL, every day at SNL is wildly different. Like Mondays are so different than Wednesdays. And the whole week is sort of this tea kettle boiling with the release coming, obviously Saturday at 11:30. And everyone who works there feels like they're to some degree inside this tea kettle, and that pressure really gets to you and I think wears you down, and everybody who works at SNL looks like 10 years older than they are. the makeup hides that come Saturday, but trust me, if you see us at Tuesday night in the hallway, it's a bunch of ghosts and zombies. So this new job, because you get the release of doing a show every night, as well as the fact that, you know, we're not doing the show at 12:30, we're doing the show at 6:30. You finish the show. I actually am getting home at like 8:30 or 9 o'clock, which is a fairly human time to walk in the door. And I found the schedule, a lot more amenable to having a healthier existence.
So let's talk about figuring out what your version of Late Night would be. One of the things you actually had to figure out was how to walk out.
You can't believe how hard that is.
No, I can believe it.
Yeah. The funny thing is, you know, they have to put a mark on the floor where you're supposed to end up every night. And just the stress of hitting that mark, I think the whole first week, I couldn't even bear to watch myself walk out because I felt like I would look like an insane person, like just like staring at a spot on the floor. Also, the trickiest part of this job the first week was just figuring out what to do with my hands.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the great discoveries I made at the show was the memory of pockets. I was like, okay, I could put one of these away. I, as a person in conversation, tend to use my hands a great deal. And I think my first couple of monologues, I looked like someone on a desert island trying to signal for a plane, a passing plane.
So, you know, on Weekend Update, you were sitting behind a desk, so you didn't really have to worry about, you know, walking out there or standing or using your hands. Those desks are really protective. So did you consider doing your opening monologue from a desk?
Well, I wanted to be different than Weekend Update. I didn't want it to be just this straight transition. And because I do like standing and telling jokes as well, mm-hmm. you know, I feel like I was really lucky to have done things like host the ESPYs on ESPN and do the White House Correspondents' Dinner and do stand-up. And so I've had sort of...
But you had a podium for the White House Dinner, didn't you?
I did have a podium for the White House Correspondents' Dinner. one that I imagine if you checked, you'd still see my grip marks in the wood. But, I enjoyed the idea, at least, of transitioning to standing and knowing that, you know, 85-90% of the show was still going to be sitting behind a desk. So, but there is something nice about doing a monologue, and that was a thing, as so certainly when we were doing our hiring as well, we wanted the show to have a really strong monologue. We thought it was something people liked. We liked the idea of it. We thought we could get really good joke writers. And one of the nice developments, I think, over the first 7 weeks was the idea that, unlike Weekend Update, when you tell a joke that doesn't get the reaction you thought it would get or expecting it to get, you sort of move on to the next joke. There's not a lot of room to play around in Weekend Update. You're in a much smaller box just with the framing of the shot. And it's been nice to sort of understand and get to learn that the monologue is, a lot of it is how good the jokes are, but a lot of it too is having fun with those jokes and sort of making it a bit of a performance piece instead of just a delivery of jokes.
Oh, you told one joke that I think was about the Spice Girls and I forget which boy band reuniting.
Yes.
And the whole joke was about, like, who cares? They're so old. And the audience, you mentioned this reunion tour with the Spice Girls and whichever boy band it was. And people are, like, whooping, like, yeah, wow, that's so great. And you were really like, oh, you're not supposed to.
Yeah. When the setup gets a completely opposite reaction of the point of view that the punchline is about to deliver, it's a very interesting place. But, you know, it leaves this space on Late Night to be very honest with the audience as far as how you, as the host of the show, sort of did the miscalculation. I think if you're honest with the audience, they enjoy that part and probably, you know, remember that more than the best joke in that monologue.
So one of the regular things that you do is you tell a story after the opening monologue.
Yeah.
And I'm gonna play one of my favorites, and this is from like early in the show, like it's the first week. But I'll just play the story, and then we'll talk about it. So this is Seth Meyers from the first week of Late Night.
One of my favorite things about getting to stay in this building, getting to stay in New York, is I love interactions with strangers in New York. I had a great one the other day. I was in a restaurant, and I had gone to the bathroom, and I walked out of the bathroom, and there was just a woman standing there. And she grabbed me by the arm and she goes, it's my son's birthday. He's a huge fan. Will you come take a picture with him? And I said, of course I will. And so she's walking over, and I guess shame on me, but I thought because of the way she was talking, we were talking like a 12 or 13-year-old kid. And I get to the table and he's 25. He's like a young man. And the look on his face, he was so bummed out. Like the look on his face was not like, oh my God, Seth Meyers. It was like, oh my God, Mom, what did you do? And it was my nightmare because he was in the center of a booth. And I was like, well, I'll just slide in on the end and you can take the picture. She's like, no, you have to be next to the birthday boy. He was not psyched to be called the birthday boy. So everybody had to get out of the booth and I had to go sit next to him. And it was like he was mad at me. He was like, oh, hey, how are you? And I felt bad for him, but part of me wanted to be like, so what do you want to be when you grow up? And so they were sitting there, and, like, everybody had to get out, everybody had to get back in. I'm sitting with him, and then the mom takes the picture. And in, like, the history of, like, moms and cell phone cameras, like, they'd never nailed the first picture. Like, she, like, took it and then looked at it and was like, I didn't get anyone. She definitely pointed it at us. So finally take it, and I got out, and he was never happy at all, any of it. And so I got up, and I left, and he said something to her under his breath, and I didn't hear what he said, but I did hear what she said, because she said it very loudly for the whole restaurant to hear, which she said, well, I am sorry, but I'm your mother. So I'd just like to say to that guy, happy birthday, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry about that bummer of a moment.
That's Seth Meyers hosting Late Night. That's such a great story.
Thank you.
Yeah, so how did you come up with the idea of, like, telling a personal story?
Well, you do these, like, test shows when you have one of these gigs. And it was the 2 weeks before we did our first show. We did 2 1 week, 3 the following week. And you have actual guests and you bring in an actual audience. And it just gives you a chance to work through the show, not just for the host, but for everybody from lighting to camera and sound. And I had a story that I ended up telling on the first night about fixing a flat tire, or I should say not fixing a flat tire. And I told it just because I thought it would be a fun thing to tell at the desk during one of the test shows. And Lauren Michaels and my producer, Mike Shoemaker, both said that was really nice because that was a moment where you went from a monologue, which I think is slightly different than what people are accustomed from you, and then to be able to sit down and show people who you really are, which is so much part of this job, unlike being a Weekend Update anchor where you're basically, to some degree, playing a character, to be able to share your personal life is, I think, a big advantage of doing a show like this. And so Lauren said, you know, you should tell that story the first night. It'll be a nice thing. You'll go into the first night knowing it's a story that works and it'll tell people a little about yourself. And then it became a thing where any day I had a story, it's a really nice place to tell it. And, you know, unlike a lot of the comedy on the show, you know, it's not on cue cards. I get to just address the camera, and I find it really settles me and it settles the show, and I've enjoyed it a great deal.
So getting back to the story itself, when somebody asks you to take a picture with them, whether it's a selfie with them or somebody else taking the picture, do you ever say no? And if you say no, are you afraid that people will tweet that you are a cold and selfish egomaniac?
It's an excellent question. I will say, if anyone's listening, I so prefer a selfie. Once somebody hands their phone to a stranger, oftentimes I find, too, that people will hand the phone to the oldest person nearby who is, have not come to terms with this new technological advancement. So I'd far – a selfie is fast. You can knock that out pretty quickly. My other pet peeve is when you're – there's a group of people who want a picture and someone says, just one more, because as if they're speaking for the group, because it's probably not the last one. But there were two people at SNL that I always remember at times like that, Derek Jeter being one and Paul McCartney being the other, who more than anyone else, I felt like everybody at SNL, from the crew to the cast to guests of the show, had something they wanted to tell them, like some moment of their career that had so affected this person. And both Derek Jeter and Paul McCartney made so much time for everybody that had wanted it. And I always remember any time I don't take a picture with someone, I'm saying I'm a bigger deal than Paul McCartney and Derek Jeter. So I try to take them as every time.
Do you miss Saturday Night Live?
I do. I miss it a little bit less every day, which is nice. The thing I was so worried about leaving SNL was just the family and the routine and all of the wonderful people that I got to spend so much time with. And obviously, as you build your a new show like we have, you find that there are other really lovely people that you get to sort of build a new family with. So that's been great. I do miss the rush of SNL. And on Saturday at 11:30, when I'm sitting at home, I feel like phantom limbs, if that's the right expression, of just wanting to be out there. So that I certainly miss.
Do you watch it, or is it too painful to watch?
I watched the first one live, which was a real I felt the way I bet.
You mean live,
Jeff,
like in the studio audience?
Live at home. No, live okay. At home, I should say. And let me just say, as a viewer, there are too many commercials.
You never
knew
that.
Now that I'm on the other side, I never knew. Or I'd known as a child and then forgotten. But I felt like just this awful metamorphosis of no longer being on the show. And then in the following weeks, you know, a couple times I've been out of town. I've had to watch it Sunday morning, which is a lovely way to watch the show. The part you miss the most not being on the show anymore is Wednesday, which was the table read where you basically get to watch 40 pieces, all with varying degrees of success. But I remember when people like Kristen Wiig left or people like Andy Samberg left, the thing that I felt, you know, so lucky about was that I got to see everything they tried to do for a 7 or 8 year period, like all their failures, all their successes. You got to see everything, like in the incubator stage to the final product. And it's so, that part of the job is so, so wonderful.
When a guest host comes on, what's the process like of deciding how to show off the guest host in the monologue?
Well, it's very interesting. If it's a guest host, you know. If it's someone who's coming back, if it's a Ben Affleck, if it's an Alec Baldwin, if you already sort of know their toolkit as far as their comedy chops go, then people often tend to try to write a monologue on a Tuesday night so you can hear it on Wednesday. With other people who are there for the sort of the first time, what sometimes happens is you want to wait and hear them on Wednesday. You get to listen to them read like 40 different pieces, and that will give you a better sense of who they are and sort of what they can pull off. But it's a very strange thing because a lot of times people host the show and the one thing that they're not great at is being themselves. You know, that's certainly true of the best actors. Whereas, you know, obviously when you have somebody like Louis C.K. and it's time for the monologue, you just blissfully get out of the way and know that he'll do all the work and it'll be as good as a monologue could possibly be. So it can be really tricky. And, you know, there are times where it just makes sense to have someone sing because they're an excellent singer and it's a great way to start a variety show. There are other times where people are very good playing off other people, so you might have cast members come out and share the burden with them in the monologue. But there are a lot of different ways to skin a cat with a monologue, and sometimes the cat even makes it out alive.
Do you ask if they have any secret gifts like singing or dancing or impressions?
That's one of the first questions you ask. You know, do you sing? Do you dance? Do you do accents? Do you have impressions? And again, that's something that, to some degree, the thing you most and least want to hear from a host is them saying, whatever you want me to do, I'm game. Because that's great, and that implies that they have the right attitude about it. But you also would love sort of five specific things that they can do better than someone else. And again, not to go back to someone like Alec Baldwin, but he's the kind of guy who shows up and is like, I think I can do Tony Bennett.
Oh, yes. Which, yeah.
But yeah, that, you know, you don't look at Alec Baldwin and naturally think, oh, perfect. You know, he'll be Tony Bennett. That sort of comes from Alec showing up, knowing how the show works, and suggesting to the writing staff, I think this would be really fun.
My guest is Seth Meyers, who now hosts Late Night on NBC. He's the former head writer of Saturday Night Live and the former anchor of Weekend Update. So you look like you were almost going to cry on your last night.
Yeah.
anchoring Weekend Update. And I thought I'd play your last words as the anchor of Weekend Update. And this is at the end of a whole bit where people who you've worked with from Saturday Night Live over the years come out. Amy Poehler, Andy Samberg. I think Fred Armisen was there.
Yes, Fred.
Bill Hader.
Fred did his Governor Patterson.
Yeah. And so I don't know if you knew that they were all going to be there or not.
I did. I was aware they were all going to be there. Yes.
Okay. So here's like your last words.
It is my last show, and I just want to say being out here with my co-anchors and my dear friend and my husband is the perfect to end. This is the job I always wanted, and I had the best time, and I met the best people, and I just want to thank the crew and the cast, and especially the writers and Lauren, and thank you very much. And take us out, Cecily.
For Weekend Update, I'm Cecily Strong.
I'm Amy Poehler.
I'm Stefan Meyers.
And I'm Seth Meyers. Good night.
So, Seth Meyers, what was going through your mind as you said that?
I was a little heartbroken. I really, you know, I'd been there for 12 and a half years, and I feel like I grew up there, and I feel like the people I met there are really, truly my closest friends. And, you know, I got married this past summer, and I mean, oh, I think we decided that, like, I think half of the people at our very large wedding were somehow connected to SNL. So it was really sad to think that was the last time I was going to sit behind that desk, because some of the greatest times of my life have been back there. And it was also the fact that Andy and Amy and Fred and Bill had all come back and, you know, had come back at sort of at first mention of the idea that I would like to have them there.
We're featuring my interview with Seth Meyers, recorded last April, but we're going to play a short excerpt of the interview I recorded with him in 2008, in which we mentioned Don Pardo, the longtime announcer on SNL, who died 1 week ago at the age of 96. What is the job of the head writer?
The best way to describe it is you're sort of the all the writers are surgeons and you're the emergency room doctor. It's just triage. The thing that most needs attention, you sort of have to drop everything and sort of give a hand to. So as head writer, you know, you just sort of, I run a rewrite table with all the writers where we sit around and pitch jokes based on what's already written. But each writer sort of gets to usher their piece through from, you know, the beginning stages to the final, you know, when it airs. Each individual writer casts their piece. They talk to set design. They talk to wardrobe. The most fun is between dress and air. If Lauren sort of needs a minute out of a piece as a head writer, you sort of get to go sit down with the writer and try to find how you're going to take a minute out of something. When it moves the fastest, it's when it's the most fun.
You're in the position of having to tell people no also, to tell a writer, this isn't going to make the final cut.
I'm so glad that that's actually not true, because it really is the greatest process, where between dress and air, everything's on a note card. And when Lauren calls the meeting between dress and air, you walk in and it's like finding out if you made the high school play or not. Your note card is either on the air side or on the cut side. So I actually very rarely have to give bad news. I'm just in the room when I see people's faces register the bad news.
Do you remember the very first time you heard Don Pardo say your name?
I do. It was the craziest thing ever. My first show was the first show after 9/11.
That was your first show.
That was my first show, which was a crazy time to be starting on the show. The only sketch I was in, I played a fish's head, a floating fish's head, which meant I had to wear a green leotard because I was in front of a green screen, and my face had to be painted green. So I was in a green leotard with a face painted green, wearing a bathrobe, standing next to a bunch of police officers and firemen. The first time I heard Don Pardo say my name, and I realized that with everything that was happening in the world, it was the most insignificant part of the night. But it was, for me, incredible.
You hosted the White House Correspondents' Dinner, in which the president comes out and makes, you know, does a little stand-up, and then a guest comic performs. And you were really funny. So, like, you're seated at the head table next to Michelle Obama, and I think next to President Obama, too. And then
He was on the other side of the podium. I was next to
her. Oh,
okay.
So you're
just
next to Michelle.
The first lady.
Uh-huh, yeah. Right. Okay. And then, so I want to play something that you said. The dinner was broadcast on C-SPAN.
Yes.
And you made some funny jokes about C-SPAN, and it will soon be clear why we've chosen this clip to play.
I am also honored to be performing for those of you here tonight, as well as the handful of people watching at home on C-SPAN. C-SPAN is, of course, the official network for wide shots of empty chairs. Every time I tune into C-SPAN, it looks like they just had a fire drill. C-SPAN is one unpaid electric bill away from being a radio station. People think Bin Laden is hiding in the Hindu Kush, but did you know that every day from 4 to 5, he hosts a show on C-SPAN?
Okay, great joke about Bin Laden. Little did you know that the next day, U.S. Navy SEALs, with the approval of President Obama, was going to get Bin Laden. So when you found out what was in store the next day, after having made that joke and after having performed with President Obama, what went through your mind?
First of all, you're just blown away because the president was great at the Correspondents' Dinner. He has like a stand-up's rhythm. Even when I watch him give speeches now, I'm like, oh, he has a stand-up's rhythm. So it's one thing that he was, you know, planning this thing that to some degree would, you know, define his presidency in the history books. But the fact that he could be planning that and also go out and just knock it dead at the Correspondents' Dinner. So that made me very jealous because I, of course, it required 110% of my concentration to do the job I did. But it's very funny, and I've talked about this a lot, but the idea of I felt so good about the job I did at the Correspondents' Dinner. And I remember taking the Acela back to New York with my father, and it was Sunday afternoon, and we were sort of sitting around feeling just on cloud nine about how the Correspondents' Dinner. This is a story of hubris. I'm telling a story of hubris. And we were feeling so good. I just remember thinking, like, when the news comes on Monday, all they're going to do is talk about how funny I was on Saturday night. As long as nothing happens on Sunday, a notoriously slow news day, Monday belongs to Seth Meyers. So it was a really funny thing that I think of everybody in the country upon hearing that Bin Laden had been assassinated. I was the one guy who was like, oh, tonight? They got him tonight?
Well, you know, President Obama was so funny. He must be like the worst opening act to follow.
Well, I want to point something out, and I'm pretty sure I'm right about this. I think the presidents used to close. I think the comedian used to go first, and Obama flipped it because he's a genius. But yeah, it's an impossible opening act to follow. And you shouldn't have to follow the president. The president should always talk last.
I was worried about you. No, I was worried. Yeah. I thought, like, oh, my God, that's going to be so hard to follow. But you were great. You were really
funny. Thank you. I do remember, because he's also, because here's why he's the worst opening act of all time. He also closes. He doesn't close with a joke. He closes, like, talking about, like, spare a thought for the troops.
Right.
It's all spare a thought for the troops and give it up for your next comedian.
So you're also in the position, hosting the White House Correspondents' Dinner, of making jokes about the president, something you're used to doing from Weekend Update. But this time around, he's sitting right next to the podium as you're making jokes about him. And the First Lady's right there, too. So how did that affect both the material and the delivery?
Well, we approached it. And when I say we, I mean myself and the numerous that were kind enough to help me out with this process, which we spent about 3 weeks on writing the material for this. We approached it knowing that he has a very good sense of humor. And even if he doesn't, he has a very smart quality, which is he knows that if you tell a joke about him, it's more attractive to laugh at that joke, get caught laughing, than get caught sort of simmering. So we knew if the jokes were sort of good enough and smart enough that we'd probably have him on our side. And it was fun. Also, you know, I think to some degree we realized that lose the president, lose the room, because it is very unique in a performance where it's not just that he's next to you. It's like if it was him in the front row, that's one thing. But him next to you means the entire audience can watch him as well. So to some degree, it might be more interesting to listen to me tell jokes and watch the president than it would be to listen and watch me.
I mean, that's really what I would do. Right. Like, how's the president taking this?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Well, let's hear an example of one of your President Obama jokes. So this is coming out of a section in which you were talking about what a weak field of Republican presidential candidates there were. So here's Seth Meyers at the White House Correspondents' Dinner 2 years ago.
So it's not a strong field, and who knows if they can beat you in 2012. But I tell you who could definitely beat you, Mr. President. 2008 Barack Obama. You would have loved him. So charismatic, so charming. Was he a little too idealistic? Maybe. But you would have loved him. I still think we all remember that inauguration day. The First Lady was there. And may I say, for as beautiful as you looked that day, you look even more beautiful tonight. Now you, on the other hand, Mr. President, have aged a little. What happened to you? When you were sworn in, you looked like the guy from the Old Spice commercials. Now you look like Louis Gossett Sr. I've never said this to anyone before, but maybe you should start smoking again. Is this the change you were talking about? Mr. President, look at your hair. If your hair gets any whiter, the Tea Party is going to endorse it.
That's Seth Meyers at the White House Correspondents' Dinner 2 years ago. So you were talking about how you know the audience was watching President Obama's face to see how he was taking the jokes.
Yes.
Were you watching his face, too? I mean, were you kind of picking up the vibe of whether he was liking it?
I did look over to him a few times during that and was aware that it was going well. And it's interesting because the section before, where I sort of had a joke about everybody in the GOP field at that time, which I do believe history has borne out that it was a fairly weak field, I found him not enjoying it. Maybe not enjoying it, but not wanting to get caught laughing at it as much.
Mm-hmm.
And I sort of ended up making a few on-the-fly cuts during that. And I'm not enjoying this. This seems like piling on to some degree.
What'd you cut? Give us an example.
I can't remember exactly, but I remember, you know, at the time, I believe there were probably 9 candidates in the GOP field, if there was, you know, April of that year. And I just remember to some degree, I was like, okay, so, you know, maybe I'll skip this Herman Cain joke. You know, maybe this is just going to seem a little too easy. Or, you know, this Newt Gingrich joke. The level of difficulty doesn't feel very high, and I feel like that room appreciates level of difficulty. Whereas one of the first things when I accepted to do the Correspondents' Dinner, one of the first things we started writing jokes about was the fact that he looks so much older and how much this job had sort of aged him. So that was something that I couldn't wait to get to. Like, I felt very good about that run of jokes.
So your performance is over. The president gets up, shakes your hand, pats you on the back, and you pat the president on the back.
Yes.
Did you say to yourself, oh, no, I just patted President Obama on the back. Like, you know, attaboy, President Obama.
That whole first 5 minutes after finishing, I sort of like my ears felt the way they do underwater. Like everything was just sort of a weird hum. So I don't remember. People have often said because, and especially, well, you know, after we found out the next day was, you know, the SEAL Team 6 assassination of Osama bin Laden, people would ask me, what did you say to President Obama? And I've always said, I told him, check Abbottabad. I feel like there's a compound in Abbottabad that doesn't smell right to me. But it was great. And I'm not being humble. This is a very genuine thing that I didn't quite. It was very strange, those 20 minutes, which is about how long it is, because it's a very strange room. Like the correspondence dinner room is very wide. People are sitting around tables, so half of the audience is just sort of craning to see you. It's a very uncomfortable room. As a comedy room, it's an F-. And the sort of sound goes straight up. So to some degree, I felt like I had done well. But I didn't quite know, to be honest. And like most comedians, I probably walked off thinking about the three or four things that I wish had gone better. And very sweetly, my phone rang like 2 minutes after I finished, and it was Senator Al Franken, who, of course, I'd sort of crossed paths with at SNL, and who had been a correspondence dinner host himself in the past, and he was very, very kind, and that was my first sense of, oh, that went really well.
Seth Meyers recorded in April. Tonight, he's hosting the Emmy Awards, which will be broadcast on NBC. Some of this year's Emmys were awarded at a ceremony earlier this month. Coming up, we hear from Allison Janney, who won for her performance on Showtime's Masters of Sex. This is Fresh Air.